Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. Congratulations. Welcome to 2023. No,
you did it.
Do
we
the bell.
Did it.
You got the bells. Yeah.
Hey, can you get sued for saying yabba dabba do?
No.
It's not trademarked in some unscrupulous way.
I think it would depend on how you did it. Like if it was Yabba Dabba Doo with the Flintstones theme behind it.
Right.
Max, super producer Max.
What?
Let's give it up for him.
I
know it's tempting.
Check us on that.
Yeah. But we
know. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's got to be public domain by now. No, maybe not. I mean, no.
Not yet.
It gets re-upped. I'm sure that one.
You just have to make something that's basically the Flintstones, but a little different, like Family Guy, you know?
Totally. Well, remember Scooby-Doo does Scooby Dooby Doo, which is very adjacent to Yabba Dabba Doo, but that's also in the Hanna-Barbera universe still. Ooh. So they're allowed to steal from themselves. What's this got to do with anything? Nothing.
We could do Rabba Habba Who.
Ben can figure out the transition. If anyone can do it, Ben is the master of transitions, of non sequitur transition. Let's see. Let's see what you got, Ben.
Oh, man.
How do we go from Yabba Dabba Doo to Gangster's Paradise?
First off, wonderful song. This is something that's been on our minds for a while. As you know, folks, we took Noel and Max and I took some time, a little R&R, a little Ridiculous Romance, I think you called it, Noel. And we hope you had a wonderful, wonderful end of the year as well. Even though calendars are relatively arbitrary, it's fun to have things.
We did
like
an episode
that.
On that.
Yep, we did. We did indeed. And and so when we're talking about Flintstones, we're talking about Hanna-Barbera and uniting. What I love that you pointed out, Noel, is that Scooby-Doo is indeed in the same universe. And in my mind, that makes them strange bedfellows, right? In my mind, whatever, we're kicking off the rust. In my mind, this makes them strange bedfellows. And when we think of strange bedfellows, there's almost no better example in American history than this very weird story. We've got a lot of people to thank, Noel. You were telling me.
He got there.
We should thank Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, Steve Buscemi and his weird eyes that are really fun to superimpose onto Disney princesses. Oh, yeah. Google it. You'll be delighted / terrified. Mm-hmm. Boardwalk Empire, I guess it was a hit. It did see itself out to its conclusion, but I felt like it wasn't like Sopranos level in terms of the way it impacted like the zeitgeist. But I very much liked it. I think they fudged some history here and there, but they largely, hit the broad strokes in terms of folks like Lucky Luciano and, Al Capone and, sort of like origin stories of a lot of these largely looming mafioso figures, in history. But what it didn't really go into was a connection between the U.S. military, fascism, and said largely looming gangster figures.
Yeah. Now, it might sound like we got together before we recorded and just pulled three ideas out of a hat. Like you said, no.
We do do that sometimes.
We have done that. And it's actually worked. We're not going to tell you which ones, though. You'll have to guess. But I love the setup here because, you know, when you think of Uncle Sam, right, according to history textbooks, and you think of organized crime, you see them as two opposed forces. But as we've learned in Ridiculous History and in Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, that's not always the case. Now, fascism, nowadays, fascism is pretty much universally acknowledged to be a bad thing.
Fascism, bad.
Yeah.
Democracy, good on paper.
You know what I mean?
Better than fascism.
Yeah.
100%. That should be the tagline for democracy. It's better than fascism.
Democracy, not great, but better than fascism.
Who was it? I can't remember who it was who said that democracy was the something like the least worst way to run a government.
Yeah, big fan of saying things like the most best or the least worst. Yes. But I mean, it's true. And, you know, even a lot of these Italian-American immigrants who kind of created or sowed the seeds of what would become La Cosa Nostra in America, you know, Italy was under a fascist regime, you know, under Mussolini. And so they didn't care for that as a political direction either, you know, because they'd seen what it could cause, or even, you know, maybe their folks back home were subject to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, are there good guys in today's story? Sort of, but this is a meaty one. This is a two-parter. We wanted to open the year with a
preemptive
nice two-parter.
Dun,
dun, dun. That's why we got two bells. yes. Yes.
It's your Christmas presents, by the way, from friend of the show, Rowan Newby.
Yes, who appeared on our Idiomatic for the People series. We've got to get him and our pal Frank. Back on. So we're going to have more guests, but right now it's just the four of us, Noel, Max, yours truly, and you listening along at home to learn a very weird story. All right. So why do we say they're not necessarily 100% good guys in this? Well, the U.S. government during World War II got even more into institutionalized racism. And they did it not because they just woke up and said, hey, let's be jerks. They did it because they were terrified. The Axis powers had brought chaos across the world. And so the U.S. government started saying, well, what about all the citizens of our country who have heritage in Japan or Italy or Germany? How American are they? Can we trust them? And as a result, they started doing some really terrible things to these innocent people.
Yeah, I mean, unless they forget that, like, a big selling point of America was this whole melting pot, you know, ideology, like, send us your poor, you're tired, you're hungry, and all that. Unless, you know, they're potential turncoats from an enemy state like Japan, Germany, or Italy.
Mm-hmm.
They were worried that because of where their sympathies might lie, that they could potentially be a rot from within. You know, they could actually cause problems for the United States from the ground, you know, or like perhaps participate in plotting and all that kind of stuff. And certainly we know things like that do happen, but it's almost always on a pretty small, lone wolfy, individualistic kind of scale. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Ben. I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah,
this was an overblown concern.
Yeah, the idea too was that it was rooted in the assumption that these people, because of their heritage, would somehow be un-American, even if, you know, their grandparents were the folks who immigrated and they knew nothing but like the Bronx, you know, or Manhattan. So this all starts. I do agree with you. They are worried about domestic terrorism, but they're kind of attributing a larger conspiracy to something without proof because they're basing it on racism. Anyway, it all hits the fan in 1942, or that's when the spark is lit. There's a U.S. troop carrier ship It was originally called the SS Normandy, and it had been renamed the USS Lafayette. It catches fire and sinks in the harbor in Manhattan, and the authorities believe this may be sabotage. This may be the work of a saboteur, a domestic terrorist. And so, the government says, you know who we got to check out? Those dock workers. And then some other guy goes, yeah, hey, a lot of them are Italian, aren't they? So they started investigating and they came up with Bupkis and they said, okay, we need some experts on the ground here. We need some folks who understand the lay of the land. And again, because of their prejudice, they immediately went to not like an Italian-American civic or community center. No, they went to the mob. And that's why Lucky Luciano is a big star of today's show.
That's right. Luciano had immigrated to the United States and settled on the Lower East Side of New York City, Manhattan, at the age of 10, and very, very early on became a member of the notorious Five Points Gang.
Oh, man.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, is like, that's the I guess, escalation, or I mean, I guess it wouldn't have been exactly the same time as the Gangs of New York
era. You were going to say it, yes.
The Scorsese picture where they're wearing the nice stovepipe hats. That would have been like the earliest iteration of that mob or that gang. This, you know, I guess if he was born, yeah, in the, well, I don't know. That was like in the late 1800s, I want to say.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the Five Points Gang originally started off with Irish-American members, and it was in the late 19th century, so late 1800s. You nailed it.
So, no, so maybe as a child, it would have been, yeah, that lines up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He might have had himself a stovepipe hat, you know, and been rolling deep with Daniel Day-Lewis and Leonardo DiCaprio type fellas.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm picturing a 10-year-old with a stovepipe hat, I'm picturing an Animal Crossing character. I'm just going to be honest with you. He probably looked
adorable. And I envy what you're picturing, man. I mean, this sounds delightful. Stovepipe hat just kind of makes everything seem, you know, it's like hard to take a guy seriously wearing a skinny stovepipe hat. Mm-hmm. But I think that's sort of what the goal is. It's like, you know, you underestimate me and then boom, you get knifed.
Yeah, maybe there's a practical thing. I mean, think of the potential storage space. Anyway, we're pretty sure that Luciano joins the gang, not because he's into the aesthetics or the haberdashery, but more so, like many young people, there aren't a lot of alternatives, right? There's a lot of discrimination in the community. And this stuff still happens and leads to the formation of gangs in the U.S. and abroad today. But big things were happening in the country at this time. Prohibition starts, right? The time we've talked about on the show multiple times. It's back when Uncle Sam had the cartoonishly daft idea to make booze illegal. And then, you know, they paved the way for unprecedented profits in organized crime. And, you know, the government was in on it too. Anyway, so this prohibition was an act of buffoonery, as well-intentioned as it might be. It was pretty much doomed to fail. And this was a great time to be in organized crime, right? You've got a brand new income stream. The money is rolling in. And Luciano, in 1920, is recruited as a gunman by Giuseppe Masseria, otherwise known as Joe the Boss.
Mm-hmm.
That's an awkward nickname, though, isn't it?
Joe the Boss, yeah. I mean, as you would say, Ben, in a burst of creativity, it's a pretty self-serving nickname. I wouldn't be surprised if he had something to do with giving it to himself.
Oh, he's just going around speakeasies going, you know, a lot of people call me Joe the Boss.
They call me Joe the Boss. I'll tell you why. It's because I'm the boss.
Oh, that's sad. Making your own nickname.
Yeah. But then, so well, you know, let's be fair. Joe the Boss is not exactly top tier,
right?
Mafia history, you know, fodder. I've never heard of Joe the Boss. Have you, Max?
Oh, absolutely not. I've never heard of it. But I do want to make a shout out to one of my friends, my friend Greg. He is known for his many attempts of trying to give himself a nickname.
Yeah.
And
it's a move. I'll give you that.
And he's really come to regret it. So, like, you know, there was one time he was hanging out with me and my friend Phil, and he's like, call me cougar, and he'll call me mountain lion. And it's like, well, man, it sounds like you want to be called a cat, so let's give you a cat name, like Mr. Fuzzy Paws.
Aw. Here's the thing, though, with those nicknames. The rules work counterintuitively in the criminal underground. Like, if you were ever unfortunate enough to be incarcerated, then you need to know that the person with the most innocuous sounding nickname is the most dangerous. There's some Correct. Guy called Snakebite, might be a cool dude. You need to watch out for the guy named Smurf. Don't talk to him.
Snakebite's a big old cuddly sweetie bear.
Sure,
Smurf, absolutely. Cold-blooded, dead-eyed killer.
Yes.
Or, you know, sometimes the ones you really have to look out for are the ones that would never get blood on their hands, or as they say in rap, never touch dope. Like Arnold Rothstein, played wonderfully, one of my favorite performances in the whole series in Boardwalk Empire, by Michael Stuhlbarg, who we know from A Serious Man. And he's also in that new movie, Bones and All, which looks really interesting.
It's a little divisive,
but I am interested in it. But Rothstein was an incredibly key figure in the early days of organized crime in the United States. And, you know, again, just like running all the grifts, you know, and really kind of writing the rule book for how organized crime would really play out, and like, you know, how the mafia would essentially, you know, just create constant revenue streams from various sources. And he worked with Luciano, who was making millions in the 1920s, mid-1920s, bootlegging, like you said, Ben, because of that genius idea Uncle Sam had. Let's make everything illegal. Everyone will just take it, right? Nobody, they'll be fine. Oh, no, instead they opened up the black market in a very, very real way. Ooh. So Rothstein, though, was in fact murdered, which opened up a big old vacancy in the crime world, which Luciano happily filled.
Yes, yeah. Rothstein, by the way, his nickname was The Brain. And he actually was from a pretty well-to-do family.
That's right.
His older brother, who he always resented, became a rabbi. So he was the like favorite child. Anyway, yes, you nailed it. It's you live by the crime, you die by the crime. So goes Rothstein off stage, and Luciano returns to work for Joe the Boss.
Yeah, who was really the one filling the gap, really. I mean, Luciano was still sort of more of a trigger man.
Yeah,
he wasn't like a lieutenant. Really, you know. Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly.
And by this time, our buddy Joe, I'm just laughing because it's just cartoonish. He has promoted himself in the nickname game. And now he's walking around saying, you know, a lot of people call me boss of bosses.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this. He definitely got an honorable mention in a creative writing class.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Boss of boss. That's like, you know, that's like some Jesus Christ kind of stuff, you know, like King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and all that stuff.
Boss of bosses.
Boss of bosses. Yeah, exactly. I'm the boss boss. That's a British thing. I like that one. Just being the boss boss. But at this point, the boss of bosses decided it was time to clean house, you know, to really make some room for his entrepreneurial spirit to thrive. So he went to war, like you do, with a rival boss of bosses, or the Duke, as he was known, Salvatore Maranzano.
Maranzano, yeah. And Luciano is not a guy really given to a moral compass nor loyalty. So he sides with the Duke in this crazy crime war, and he helps set up the boss of bosses for an assassination in 1931. So Joe the Boss is murdered with the help of his own lieutenant. And before 1931 ends, Luciano and his other colleagues, who are now being called the Young Turks, they also kill the Duke. And now they're saying there's a new there's a new regime in the criminal underground. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a 3-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, nah, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves and it's super convenient. And it actually, like, we tried to find a catch and there's not one.
So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I,
yeah.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos and the last one, God bless it. I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Maranzano's assassination comes about because of a gang from Murder Incorporated. Shout out to Ja Rule. And Noel, you're more familiar with Boardwalk Empire. Do they get into any of this stuff here?
It escapes me at the moment. They cover a lot of ground in a relatively tight, you know, I think 3 or 4 seasons. Mm-hmm. So I can't quite remember, but I do want to say there is an actual brick and mortar place and an associated website called the Mob Museum.
Yes.
The National Museum of Organized Crime and Law Enforcement, which we got a good bit of this this research from. And it is in downtown Las Vegas.
Not so to profile.
It does make a little bit of sense. I definitely want to check it. I think I'm actually going to Vegas for the very, very, very first time in a couple of months. So I definitely plan to make a trip there. I'm finding all this out in real time, folks. So, I'm
nice. Anything special?
Well, Ben, let's not spill the beans yet because surprise, surprise, pretty sure you're going to be going too. And we might be doing a little something about the very topic we're discussing right now.
Oh, but that's right. Secret project.
Don't want to put the cart before the horse. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Folks, it's so hard for us to, like, we're guys who literally talk for a job. So we're so weirdly proud of ourselves when we can keep a project secret. This is a great teaser, though. So, all right, Luciano as a result of all these assassinations, Luciano comes in, as you would kind of foreshadowed earlier, Noel, to fill the vacuum of leadership. And he loves organizing. He likes having meetings. He's one of those guys, you know? He like has parties and stuff.
So. Yeah, scrapbooking parties even, you know? A real stickler for the details and for, you know, paste.
And, he had the funny scissors.
And sheets of, the funny scissors. And those, what are those plastic sheets? Acetate?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. The stuff that you put on top of the pages so that the pictures don't get ruffled.
Mm-hmm. And he was also, of course, still into crime. And he continued this cooperative, this loose confederacy called the Five Families, the Committee of the Five Families. And this would go on to control all the East Coast criminal rackets for decades and decades. But Luciano wanted a little more credibility. He said, I don't want to call myself boss of bosses. It's kind of sad and lame to go around telling people to call me that.
Little gauche.
Yeah, just call me the chairman of the board. And now we're going to have national meetings. And we're going to organize this. We're going to get a spreadsheet involved. Let's avoid the blood and let's make money together.
And it's funny, too, speaking of Vegas, you know who went on to borrow that nickname?
Who?
Frank Sinatra.
Oh, that's right.
He was referred to as the chairman of the board.
Yeah.
Don't know if he ever directly murdered anybody, but I wouldn't be surprised with his connections if he maybe had some people killed.
100%. He also did some pretty dastardly stuff. He was the guy who...
He's a dirty, dirty boy.
He's a dirty boy. He had a quotation where he said, it's amazing what a broad will do for a buck or something like that.
Yikes.
Yeah. And he wasn't talking about choreography.
No.
So Luciano is still continuing criminal enterprises, but he's trying to make it more corporate, essentially. And he also immediately gets a target on his back because he's a very public leader of a group that does very illegal stuff. Mm-hmm. And law enforcement has their eye on him, specifically a young prosecutor, up-and-comer in New York, named Thomas Dewey.
Yes, and Dewey and his assistant, who was an African-American woman named Eunice Carter, they were seeing some things. They were making some observations, and they were finding them pretty sus in terms of the sex workers who were being arrested. They were seeing filtering through the justice system, were being represented by the same bondsmen and lawyers that worked for Luciano. Wonder what that's about.
This sounds like a conspiracy to me. So they said, all right, let's strike while the iron is hot. We're going to do a massive raid. In 1936, Carter and Dewey raid tons of brothels throughout New York. They arrest more than 100 people and they set bail pretty high. Of the people they arrest, most are women, and quite a few of them cannot afford the $10,000 bail. $10,000 in 1936. You want an inflation calculator?
Well. Yeah. Oh my God. Can we boop, boop, beep, boop,
boop?
$10,000 in 1936 is worth $214,395.68.
Can we just say, too, I'm not trying to high horse or soapbox here, but a lot of these, you know, these types of prohibitions were based in sort of puritanical Christian morals, and there's all this morality, you know, mongering or whatever. And I think it's absurd that sex work is still illegal in many parts of the world. You know, I mean, it's absolutely something that's based in this kind of evangelical, you know, bent.
Sex work is real work. You know what
yes.
I mean? And we have
hard work.
Yeah. And to pretend otherwise is just willfully misleading. And also, you know, to, again, without soapboxing too much, we have to admit the reality of this, which continues today. A lot of these people who are being arrested are victims themselves. They've been forced into
this. They've been trafficked.
Right, right. They're not doing it for funsies. And so some of the people who get arrested, they flip and they give information to the prosecution team that leads to Lucky Luciano having an unlucky arrest. And he gets taken to trial in 1936. On June 6th of that year, he's convicted on no less than 62 separate charges of compulsory prostitution, which lands him 30 to 50 years in the state pen. And he can't get out of it. He can't buy his way out of it. So after he gets the message and he sees the writing on the wall, he turns over leadership of the National Commission of Mafioso to a guy named Frank Costello.
Also, I just want to kind of jump in here real quick and point out that we have an upcoming episode where we're going to talk about Thomas Dewey a little bit more and a part of history that he is in an exclusive group with that is not a group you want to be part of, let's just say.
Yes, an artfully done tease by super producer Max Williams, especially because off mic, I don't know about you, Noel, but I was thinking, Dewey,
we did that one. I remember that. It is not an episode that we have recorded yet. It is one that is in the works. So it was nice to realize that we have completely lost our minds during these quote unquote down times. But moving on, we got a big high watermark moment in history and in this story. And just, let's talk about looming large. Pearl Harbor. Heard of it? Seen the movie? Not very good. But the events, absolutely was a trigger, obviously, for our intervention into the war and for further anti-foreigner kind of mentality in the United States and the idea of truly cracking down on these perceived outsiders because of what they might be able to accomplish, in secret communications with their, their masters across the pond.
Yeah, so we're going back to, we're picking up that thread we laid down in the beginning about the U.S. government. And this is what we mean when we say this story is meaty. We're cinematically cutting into all these different slices of American history. You're absolutely right, Noel. People were trying to play the spy game, right? It's its own separate theater of every war. And the ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, knew that war was coming. And by the mid-1930s, they had started building up this corps of reserve officers they called the Naval Intelligence Volunteer Service, or NIVS. These folks were not your typical shake-and-bake soldiers or your typical enlisted members of the Navy. They were lawyers. They worked with the newspapers. They might be PIs. They might be executives at shipping companies. They might be linguists. Just they were kind of assembling like a heist crew for intelligence. They had their specialties. And then they were given training. They were not paid. In 1935, there were 500 of them. But by 1940, there were almost 3,000. And they started getting their cards pulled. They were called up to active duty.
Also, shout out to the Naval Criminal Investigative Services History Project.
Yes.
NCISAHistoryProject.org or is NCISAHistory.org. What a specific organization. I love it.
Rear Admiral Tom Brooks.
Yeah, exactly. Our research associate, Dr. Zach, found this wonderful article by Rear Admiral Tom Brooks, retired U.S. Navy, that really goes into detail about the naval intelligence connection with the mafia during World War II. So this is like fabulous research material that if anyone wants to read the full thing, it's a PDF that you can get online. And we highly recommend you doing so.
Yeah, and big thanks, of course, to Admiral Brooks. So in the beginning of 1942, as any World War II enthusiast knows, German U-boats were hammering the supply lines of the Allied forces. And in just January of that year, Axis submarines had sunk 20 different Allied vessels, including a tanker. And the tanker was a very scary shot across the bow because that thing was taken down just 60 miles off the Long Island coast. And people were saying, how can German submarines German submarines get all the way across the pond and operate on the coastline of the United States. Somebody called those naval intelligence dudes, and they said, here's what we think's happening. We think that there are some very unpatriotic people on the East Coast, and they're using their American fishing vessels to resupply these submarines somewhere near Long Island. These guys might be ex-prohibition folks who, you know, lost all their money when the U.S. got over prohibition, or it might be a huge conspiracy of more or less like spies, sleeper agents, all around the port of New York. So they call in a guy named Captain Roscoe McFall, who is a naval veteran. He has been with the Navy for 40 years. He knows his stuff. He's the chief intelligence officer for the 3rd Naval District. And that's a huge region. That's New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut all together.
Yeah, exactly. So the captain was very much in need of taking quick action in order for the Allied war effort to be a success. On February 9th, 1942, fire engines responded to a massive blaze at Pier 88 in Manhattan. This was an arson, let's call it what it is, that destroyed the French-built superliner, is what they referred to as, the Normandy. And this is something that, you know, couldn't be ignored, both physically and geopolitically.
Yeah. And we don't have to do the sound effect, but for everybody wondering, $5 million in 1942 is worth more than $91 million today.
A boop.
Indeed. And not the kind of boop you want to get, right? So the fire that takes down the Normandy, people are jumping to, and they're trying to not just contain the fire, but also save the port and the other ships, right? So the fire boats are dumping hundreds of thousands of gallons of water onto the superliner, and they mess up because they put so much water on it that the ship goes into a list. So it gets wonky by about 30 degrees. Everybody looking is panicking, right? And this is a huge L for the American forces. This vessel could carry 10,000 troops. It could go across the Atlantic in just 4 days, in less than a week. So, of course, the Navy says, all right, somebody else knew how important this ship was. We think it was probably the Nazis. Our guy, Captain Roscoe, says, no, look, I read the FBI file, and the FBI's explanation says this was an accident, a spark from a blowtorch. I don't buy it. This is also a symbolic attack. It makes us look weak, and we need to figure out what's really going on here. So Captain Roscoe gets those Navy operatives in plain clothes. They're not dressed as sailors. And I really like the way that Gregory Peduto describes it at Warfare History Network. I think we both love this. We'll just read you the quote here. Plainclothes Navy operatives descended upon the New York docks seeking information. With their best Jimmy Cagney impersonations, Ivy League-educated naval officers crept into the raucous haunts frequented by longshoremen. The stevedores met the agents with a threatening brick wall of silence. Mm. I like the Cagney impersonation for some reason.
I do. I also love the brick wall of silence. It's what they made you sit in elementary school.
Oh, when, yeah.
When people got too raucous, you know. Okay, we're gonna do the brick wall of silence, children.
And this is a strange thing for us to think about, right? This is an intelligence operation now, and these guys who might be a little divided by class because they're from the upper crust and they're trying to talk to dock workers, these guys don't get immediate success, right? Because the officers are very much outside of this culture. And a lot of these ship workers are just instinctively not going to trust someone they A, don't know, and B, is wearing a uniform. It doesn't matter who they are. We're just rejecting that authority. And the longshoremen
love that
job title, by the way, for the longest time. I didn't know what it meant, but you always heard people using it to refer to kind of a roughneck, you know, like someone that's a little bit rough around the edges, that might swear a little bit, perhaps catcall a lady. But no, it does refer to individuals who load and unload ships, and the term is sort of like a shortening, I guess, of along the shore. There are folks who hang out along the shore, and, you know, the technology obviously has changed over the years to render them a little bit less, you know, crucial, but it used to be they would even like have these poles and like pull the boats in closer and then unload them and all that stuff.
Yeah. And this
great season of the Wire talking about longshoremen in Baltimore.
And the mob really does control this industry, these longshoremen. And the mob has given the green light to these guys to beat the snot out of people who are asking too many questions. A reporter down at the docks, you know, better walk right, as they say in Midnight Special.
Indeed.
And so...
Because, you know, yeah. the idea of the mob controlling the longshoremen, it you probably put this together yourselves, or you've seen or read about it, it's so they could steal things.
Oh, 100%.
You know, it is literally the entryway into the world of goods, you know, coming in. And, you know, it's, oop, it fell off the back of a truck, that whole expression, you know, or out of a boat. And they would do it in such a way where it wouldn't, you know, raise so much suspicion. So it had to be done kind of in an organized fashion. And that was controlled by the mob.
And they had a portfolio of pursuits regarding the ports and shipping, because you could also cooperate with some third party to hold a shipment at a port, right, and screw somebody else's business over. You could force people to pay protection money, right, to make sure their stuff doesn't fall off the back of the proverbial truck. You're making money hand over fist, is what we're saying. And the Navy quickly realizes that they cannot infiltrate this. They're not doing it the right way, and they may not have the tools to do so because the American mafia runs the harbor. And we had this is something from Warfare History Network, O&I warrant officer named Maurice Kelly talked about this with the benefit of retrospect. And this is a pretty blunt description of what they were dealing with.
That's right. And he said this: only the American mafia claimed an utter dominance of the dock. Union officials and people in illegal operations along the waterfront had as much influence with conditions on the dock as the shipping people themselves. And in many cases, to your point, Ben, more.
Oh, yeah.
So the Navy saw this as a point of opportunity. You know, like if we play nice with the mob, then they can give us insider information that will help us in our efforts, you know, to root out the rats, as I guess it were.
A lesser evil, right? Kind Correct. Of an ends justify the means.
And it's one of those things where you say, okay, this is temporary arrangements. You know what I mean? We're going to help you. You're going to help us. And then, you know, when all this is over, we're probably going to go back to being bitter enemies, you know.
Exactly. It's the way we deal with Jonathan Strickland.
Correct.
So, man, he was
a bit of a crime lord of annoyance himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh man, gotta love him though, because you know he's unapologetic about it.
You don't have to.
Well, he just goes in. He commits.
He does commit to the bit. No question.
So yes, strange bedfellows indeed. The Navy is weighing this moral quandary, but not very long. And you can understand their calculus, because they're saying, we don't want to be the people who were in charge when the next superliner goes down, when the next vessel is attacked. And we all know we were too Pollyanna to really solve the problem. So they say, all right, we're going to try to just swallow our pride for a second, work with the mob, because we have to fight a greater evil, right? And they can make a good appeal to the mob too, because it's like, hey, you guys, things that are bad for the U.S. might also be bad for your bottom line, and that's what you care about. So,
that's right. It was a very quid pro quo kind of situation, and they had to kind of make the sales pitch to the mob. But you know, they sort of saw the benefit.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills.
I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Yeah, this is okay. This is where it gets very strange. So they figure it out. We don't know what that boardroom or that meeting room looks like, but eventually they concede they're gonna have to contact the mob, just like you said, Noel. But this guy, Lucky Luciano, has been sent up the river, and there are a lot of people who are trying to run things at this point. You know, in addition to Costello, so. There's this guy named Joseph Lanza. His friends call him Sox.
like the Clinton's cat.
Yes. The Clinton's cat is named after Joseph Lanza.
To your point, Ben, I bet this guy was an absolute psychopath right. With a name like that. He had to have been, you know, like they call him Sox because he, you know, cuts your feet off. Yeah. I don't know.
Why do they call him Sox? I pray you never find out.
I pray you never find out. He was just a big fan of fancy socks, you know?
Yeah, and
you wear those men's garter things that hold your socks up.
Oh, yeah.
I think
yeah.
All gangsters did in those days. It was of the fashion.
It was so weird. Having your socks tall was way more important back then.
Agreed.
Yeah. I don't know if I would. You know, that's one I don't miss.
I think it was just more of an era of tailored suits, and that often meant like the height of the pants were a little bit shorter. You know, that was the style. So you would see the sock. You'd be more likely to see the sock.
Yeah, I love a tailored suit, though. That unreservedly. So this guy, Sox, we can tell you the real reason for his name, and it's not as funny as, it's not as good as our ideas, just to be honest. Not blowing smoke. I'm just objectively, we have better pitches. His real, the real origin of his name, Sox, comes from his insane fighting ability. He's like a one-punch knockout dude. and he oversees Manhattan's Fulton Fish Market for his buddy Lucky Luciano. And because Lucky Luciano is getting locked up for decades, an assistant district attorney named Murray Gerfein and the mob lawyer for old Joey Sox, they get together and they say, hey, maybe this is our guy that we approach about helping us fight for America. Maybe we can appeal to his patriotism. Maybe we can pay him. Let's figure something out because we think it's an opportune time.
That's so funny, Ben. I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, there's a character in The Sopranos named Joey Pants.
I love it.
He would have been right at home with Joey Sox. And, we jumped the gun with our conjecture about the sock nickname. But still, it's easy to mistake socks. I mean, back in the day, you know, I guess I sock you in the jaw or whatever. But still, I think it was ambiguous enough to warrant our theory about, you know,
our ideas were just nickname. Good. Our ideas were good. We should be in charge of more nicknames.
We should. Yeah, I was chairman of the board of nicknames. So, yes, this is Fulton Fish Market, which is, in fact, an active fish market, but also a hotbed of illegal activity. So, around midnight on March 26th, 1942, there was a bit of a huddle on a bench huddle. Gotta love those. Uptown in a park called Riverside Park. Lovely park. To collude, to form a literal conspiracy. The Naval Office of Intelligence, or sorry, the Office of Naval Intelligence, the ONI, they needed themselves a rat, an informant, someone from the inside who could feed them information, you know, that they might be getting from the docks. You know, you hear things along the docks. People are coming from faraway lands oftentimes and bearing tales of their travels. And sometimes there might be a name, perhaps a little detail, something that was overheard. Who knows?
Yeah. Keep your eyes and your ears open. Be discreet. And they're very clear. They say, look, we understand that we're usually on different sides of the game. We're not going to give you immunity for any criminal activity that may or may not be happening at the docks. We're not going to pay you a ton of money. We're appealing to your patriotism. We can agree Nazis are bad for business. Same with those fascists, bro. Same with the fascist. Don't sock me. These are just the facts. And a week later, Sox goes and meets with the commander of the Office of Naval Intelligence. And according to the records, you can find PDFs of this, Lanza tells the ONI commander, you let me know where you want the contacts made or what you want, and I'll carry on. And this marks the beginning of what would be called Operation Underworld.
Ah, I wish it was Operation Underwear. That'd be
so much better.
Our ideas. You know, hey, hit us up for nicknaming people,
sure.
Mobsters, criminals, yeah. Regular folks. We'll
cool
do whoever.
Secret
undercover operations. So this was a good thing. This is a very good thing. Lanza seems to be willing to play ball. And this, again, not only are dock workers dealing with, you know, folks coming in on these vessels, they're also dealing with the truck drivers, you know, the Teamsters.
Ooh.
It really was this kind of hub, you know. So with all of this, this network of informants, essentially, it was not just one. It was the whole shebang. It kept the ONI fully informed about any, you know, odds and ends that came in on fishing vessels, for example, like, you know, flotsam and jetsam, bits of things that were found floating out in the ocean, stuff like airplane scraps or perhaps even human remains, you know, or like flares or whatever. So this was stuff that they could use to literally kind of get the lay of the land in terms of what flyovers, you know, who might be spying perhaps, or folks maybe encroaching, you know, on our territory because, you know, Pearl Harbor really knocked us out of that complacency in terms of like, not on our soil. This is never going to happen here.
Right.
These are things that happen to other countries. You know, now the rules have changed.
100%. And it's hard to really understand the extremity of this situation, right? Unless you were there, because these were people very much working with the enemy and folks on every side of the equation had a lot of skepticism about this. Even Lanza's people were worried that he had turned They said, look, you say you're supporting the war effort. I get it. Nazis are bad for business. But how do I know you're not working with the DA to jam me up? And like, it's a good question.
Like long term, big picture, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so we made this handshake gentleman's agreement. I guess you said they didn't give them immunity, though, right? That was clear.
Exactly.
But they're not necessarily. Yeah, that's weird, right? Because they are kind of observing them, their whole enterprise, their whole operation, by virtue of them participating in this network of informants. It acknowledges the existence of said informants and said kind of participation in all of this this DOC activity. So that's a weird one, isn't it?
It is. It's definitely not a sustainable situation. And everybody realizes that in the world of intelligence, one of the biggest things to learn is not always, you know, the information you're targeting. It's the ways in which that information is acquired and disseminated, right? How, it's not necessarily what you know all the time, it's how you learned it. And giving the keys to that machine over to the US Navy, that's not a good look. Anyway, also, let's mention, right, Lucky Luciano family, his crew, they love Sox. They're like, Sox is so much fun. He gets this, you know, 15% discount off the fish.
Right hook on that fella, let me
right
tell you.
Hook is amazing. But the other four crime families are annoyed AF by this guy. So if the Navy wants to really get in behind the curtain here, they have to work with those other four families. So they need the approval of a guy named Albert Anastasia. His street name is High Lord Executioner.
Whoa.
No. See, chill.
That, okay. I kind of feel like that one probably was earned. I don't think that I don't think this guy was a squishmallow. Okay. I think this guy meant business.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Lord High Executioner. It's got a smacks of royalty, doesn't it? You know?
These guys really wanted to be aristocrats.
They really did. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah. This guy is so hashtag no chill that even Sox doesn't want to mess with him.
No, he doesn't. Sox was very aware, as was, I imagine, anyone in his circle, of Anastasia's ruthless demeanor, you know, his absolute explosive, you know, violent rages that he might fly into. And the fact that he had a bit of an itchy trigger fingy, he was not one to hold back lead, you
itchy
know,
when trigger
given the
fingy?
Opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Poetry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lanza also just didn't have enough juice to kind of like bridge the gap, you know, in terms of the divide between these different ethnic groups. You had your Irish gangsters that controlled Hell's Kitchen, which is like kind of it's sort of adjacent to like where a lot of the Broadway theaters are. It's not terribly, it's sort of like the next kind of area over. We spent a decent amount of time there in our work travels in the past. So that area is under the control of the Irish. Around the Hudson River piers, which included, again, we've got piers, we've got railway terminals, we've got, you know, warehouses and things like that. So in order to for the Navy to be able to acquire and organize the West Side docks, they had to get cooperation now from the Irish, which is, you know, the Irish and the Italians don't get along. So
no.
They don't really have suction within their already existing agreement, you know, with the Italian mafia.
So they already have a lot of what you would call stakeholders in corporate America, right? And these stakeholders don't all get along. But
why can't we all just get along?
Why can't
is what I ask.
You know, especially if we're trying to fight Nazis. So they're going to make it work, right? They're fighting for a greater good. So on June 4th, Lansky and a Lucky Luciano's mob lawyer, Moses Polakoff, that's a cool name, and old Sox, they travel to Great Meadow and they decide they're going to plan their moment. This is a big win at work for our buddy Sox, because Lucky Luciano says, you have my permission to use my name on the streets. So now, you know, he can go around and oversee the whole operation, say, hey, I am speaking on behalf of Luciano, of boss Luciano. So if you hear something from me, you need to treat it like it came from him.
I want to know more about this Great Meadow. This sounds like, is this like a Camp David kind of situation? Is this where they're going on like a retreat, you know, to do team building exercises and plan their attack?
Great Meadow is the maximum security prison where Lucky Luciano is held.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm glad we're talking about this because it does sound like it's a nice subdivision, right?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. It reminds me of like, what's that movie? The Land Before Time, where they're all going, they're heading for the Great Valley, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then Littlefoot's mom dies. Spoiler alert.
Come on, man.
The movie's 25 years old at this point. No, older. Jeez. God, we're old. Very sad. Took a lot of cues from Bambi there.
Ugh. And this is where we see Operation Underworld is gaining traction. It's happening. The mob and the United States government have teamed up in the weirdest way, and the story's just getting started. Thank goodness we did a preemptive two-parter here, because we're going to have to pause and come back with you this Thursday in just a few days to dive into the end results of Operation Underworld.
Things heat up and flexes are flexed, let's just say. Luciano's got a kind of a surprise coming his way. We'll leave it at that. In the meantime, why don't you hit us up on our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians, and let us know any other ridiculous mafia stories that we should cover, because we love this stuff. This one is such a fabulous intersection of these two things that we dig, you know, World War II history and the history of organized crime in the United States. You can also find Ben and Max and I as individuals on the internet. I lurk exclusively on Instagram, where I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
In a burst of creativity, I am calling myself at Ben Bolin, B-O-W-L-I-N, on Instagram. You can get a behind-the-scenes look at some of the weird stuff we're getting into for various shows. You can also hit us up with any questions or suggestions. You can also go to Twitter, at Ben Bolin, HSW, where you will see not just me, but also the one and only Mr. Max Williams.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter, at @ATL_MaxWilliams. Where I'll mostly just be trolling Ben Bolin, and that's about it.
Nicknames. Also send us cool nicknames. Oh, no, before we go to part two of this, call it a day, I wanted to give you a couple of weird mob nicknames. Can I just laundry list them real quick?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, man, I relish these.
All right. Anthony Big Tuna Accardo.
Oh, these are real ones.
These are real ones.
Mm-hmm.
Louis,
not to be confused with Jim from The Office. He also got the nickname Big Tuna.
He did?
Andy Bernard. Yeah, Andy Bernard, because he was eating like a tuna sandwich one day, and now all of a sudden he's Big Tuna.
I'm going to save, you know what, we'll just do rule of three. I'll give you one more. I'll give you two more. Donald, the Wizard of Odds, Angelini. A lot of these are just too long.
That's pretty clever, though.
It is cool.
Say, the Wizard of Oz.
But it's long.
It's a little long. No one would call it. That'd be the Wiz for sure, maybe.
There we go. And the one I wanted to end on, I'm sure there's a story behind this. Luigi Baby Shacks Minocchio.
Boom.
Baby Shacks.
How do you spell that? Like S-H-A-C-K-S?
Yeah, nailed it.
S-H-A-Q-S. Okay, cool. Yeah, another one wouldn't have made sense. Baby Shacks. What is a Baby Shack?
I don't know.
Very untoward. That sounds very sketch.
We'll find out in part two.
I guess we will. In the meantime as well, once again, more meantime, thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here at Spirit, Eves Jeffcoats out in the world making moves, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quizster, long may he reign?
Yeah.
I guess.
Sure. On his side of the, you know, things.
Yeah, indeed. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.